It is May 10th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, the week in geek news and your calls with questions about technology.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we are covering the Week in Geek News. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org right now and participate in our forums or send us email. Monday morning on Talk of the Bay, believing you're right, even when you're wrong. Neuroscientist Robert Burton talks with KUSP's Robert Poley about our brain's often unjustified sense of certainty. That's Monday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And speaking about neurology, next week's Geek Speak, we will have the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Dr. Stephen Novella, an academic neurologist talking about skepticism. So that's next week's show on KUSP GeekSpeak. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Ben Jaffe.
Morning, Lyle. Good
morning. Ryder Brooks.
Good morning, Lyle.
Good morning. And Alex Slias over phone. Morning, Alex.
Good morning, Lyle.
So I think we'll start off the news with Alex. Sir? Hi.
Hi. I guess we'll let's go into some discussion, about Google and their Street View kind of product where they have their, the kind of maps where you can click in and you can kind of see what it looks like as if you were standing there on the street.
So we're talking about like Google Maps. If you go to Google and you click on the Maps button and then you search, you can see satellite view, you can see like a map view and a hybrid view, and then some places you can see what's called Street View. I actually have never used it, but it's basically photos of the street, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of neat because it's like you can kind of step through position as if you're driving down the street and you can look around to your left and right. Well, apparently, they're going to hit some issues when they were going through Paris. They were kind of going through it, and they're bumping up against some of the laws in France where they citizens actually have a right to their own image when they're going about their day-to-day lives. And so they're kind of getting into that conflict with some of the laws in Europe, and particularly France in this case, where people have a little bit more right to their own image while they're in public.
And here, if you're in public and someone takes a photograph of you, actually you own that photograph and you can do anything you want with it, right?
The person taking the photograph, yeah.
Yeah. So a person doesn't have any privacy rights when they're in the public in the sense of image here in the U.S.?
In the U.S.? I don't believe so. Not as far as if you're in public, there is no expectation of privacy.
Now, is this making Google pull back from launching the service in Paris?
Well, so far they're not launching yet. They're just kind of gathering the data, and I guess they're looking at ways to maybe either edit or modify the photograph so that they could still retain.
Seems to me you could take the images and just mask the people with cartoony people or something.
Yeah, or even possible maybe to scan everything in kind of duplication and compare images and just remove people from that particular view.
I think that'd probably do composite images. Well, that'd be kind of neat, too. If they produced that, they'd have an image of a city that doesn't have people in it, which is a little eerie.
Yeah, that'd be kind of creepy.
Or they could just take, an image of one person and just populate them over everyone so that, Waldo's everywhere in Paris,
Well, they definitely have technology to figure out what... to have computers figure out what parts of images are people and what parts are not. They use that for terrorism in the London subway. And they can tell if people put down bags, they can tell how many bags the person has and where they are. And if they walk away and the bags are sitting there, then the computer will alert the...
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
So that's
the technology that drives it is amazing.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for doing that. Let me see. All right, that story's live on our site. Love that. Let's go ahead and go to Ryder.
So there's a new Doctor Who series that's been out for a few years now, and it's got a bit of a fan base. There's one fan that is a hobbyist knitter, and he's made patterns of some of the Doctor Who characters on his website.
So he knits?
He knits.
Okay.
And he knits, and it's not like he's making, but I mean my patterns, at least the demonstration that I've seen in the photographs is, it's like a little cute little mini doll that's three-dimensional.
Characters
three,
of Doctor character, Who.
Yeah, so it's three-dimensional knitting. And there's a nice little picture. It's a creature called the Ood, which is kind of like a kind of squiddy humanoid thing with the ball coming out of his mouth. And a nice little picture of it. But the BBC, who is the producer and you know creator of the Doctor Who series, they got upset that he did this. And they're claiming copyright infringement. And
well, that's true. Yeah. It's their image, right?
It is. But, you know, he's not charging it. It's just silly. You know, it's one of those examples of things that you can do, but should you really do?
Right. So I guess he has to come up with a different name for it.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's probably not even that close of an image, right?
Well, it was the patterns as well. It was pretty... It was pretty recognizable.
Okay, but
you know,
if
it's a character design, I guess you know,
yeah.
is that the copyright? Is the character design? You know,
I think it has to do with how much detail it is. But no, I don't think you can reproduce in a painting form, for example,
yeah.
a character, and that's your work. That's just how it is. But using the name, using the actual trademarkable name, that might be an issue.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if the patterns include, like, you know, the splash for the Doctor Who, the emblem. I'm not sure.
Sure.
All the patterns have been taken down.
It's one of those things. It's like, how could they possibly think that that's a problem? Like, there's a fan that's avidly making characters.
I mean, how is that taking away their ability to make money off this or infringing on them?
Yeah. Are you sure it's knitting and not crochet?
Knitting, yeah.
Okay, and here's the first question for the listeners. Who knows a person that knits? What's their name? I mean, I'm assuming that you're not a knitter. It's actually probably something a little more complicated.
I think you're a knitter.
I think there's probably a term for it.
Well,
but somebody will tell us.
I have a friend that's
a
good knitter.
A knitter.
I'll follow up.
Yeah.
I think knitter does work.
Yeah, knitting, knitter.
I believe knitter works. Yeah. But
knitter is a noun. It's a derivative of knit.
I get it. I'm saying there's got to be a name for that.
It just sounds wrong to you?
People that do theater or thespians, there's always a weird name for a thing that's very focused, you know?
Yeah, it's like...
That's what I'm saying.
I see.
So I'm inviting people to contact us with a term.
Either that or it's pronounced very strangely, like flautist.
You mean something like
flautist,
categorical of the whole medium that they use?
Yeah,
like so crocheters.
I mean, is there a giant discrepancy between knitters and crocheters? I know it's a different form of tying.
Well, I have a good friend that's an avid knitter, so I'll ask
her. Okay, you ask. Yeah, okay. I have a friend too, and I'll ask her too. Anyway, if you want to fill in the geeks on the whole... use of string, let us know. Go to geekspeak.org.
I'd love to remark kind of back on the whole Ood thing, though. It's kind of interesting, though, that last night was one of the sci-fi episodes of Doctor Who that actually had, you know, Ood as the characters. So, kind of current and relevant, given that they actually just had an episode of it last night.
This is right.
What is the URL?
The Ood?
Yeah, the Ood. Do you have a knitted version of it?
I prefer seeing
my iconography in knits.
Yeah. Do you want to see the picture?
That's a weird image.
Just throw me a link and I'll throw up on the Geek Speak site. All right, let's go to the next news story. Ben, you were the last one in, so the last one to get news story.
Oh,
just squeezed it in the under the wire. Thank you for coming in. What's your news story today,
Sam? I want to talk about the duck-billed platypus, which is a very, very, very strange creature because it has attributes that are mammalian, reptilian, I'm forgetting all the words.
It lays eggs, it has hair, it's got a beak and webbed feet.
It's just really bizarre. And they have determined they've mapped all the DNA of the duck-billed platypus. And sure enough, down to its DNA, it has... avian and reptilian and mammalian genes down to its DNA. None of these
How did that happen?
I don't know.
Do they know? Do the scientists know?
I don't know. One of the quotes is, "It's such a wacky organism." I think it's funny that...
Well, I think it's just like, it's one of those course of evolution, the species that just stopped in the middle of evolution. It found its harmony, you know, and it stayed there, but it was... You know, it was a precursor to modern mammals and has, you know.
It has genes for making milk, even though it doesn't have nipples.
Wow.
It's just really bizarre.
See, well, like really marsupials
it has, as well. Right? It has genes for making snake venom.
Well, marsupials do produce milk. They don't have nipples. It's in the pouch. Yeah. Is that, it does have a pouch? The duckboard platypus? I don't think it does.
I don't know.
I mean, what you're saying is it's got genes to make milk, and yet it doesn't have any kind of organ that can actually produce the milk.
Exactly.
And that's,
or
that's
or that can,
I think they have a pouch.
Yeah. The
well, I mean, same with the snake venom. They have genes that...
Wait, where's the platypus from? Where's it native to?
Australia.
Of course. Yeah.
It's, I think it's the eastern part of Australia, the eastern coast.
Don't all marsupials come from Australia? Isn't that where the only place that marsupials are?
I don't know. That's where the stereotype is.
You know, we're doing a lot of... call us up and tell us how we don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
That's good.
We're just not geeky enough today.
Today huh? People are telling us stuff. Yeah. We won't be helping people. But
You know, I found really interesting about that was the sex chromosomes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you know, they have, was it 8 or 10?
Five times as many.
So they have 10 genes. And they don't. It's not standard XY chromosomes like mammals. They have W chromosomes, and you know, and some of these that just don't have
what
any.
Is this? So how does
they're actually their sex determination has apparently nothing to do with their XY or their W chromosomes. And
wow,
yeah.
So is it environmental? So they're born.
You know
without,
what I read? It wasn't even clear. They didn't elaborate on that.
Do they differentiate between sex at some point? One of them is a male, and one of them is a female.
Yes, definitely.
Wow.
The only rule, which doesn't work when it self-references, but everything has an exception. I guess the duck-billed platypus is an exception. And you can't apply that rule to itself because...
Everything but that rule has an exception.
Exactly.
Okay. So the duck-billed platypus, mammal-laying eggs, weird enough,
yes.
And also really strange chromosomes.
That produces venom.
And milk.
It
produces venom?
Yes. It produces
snake venom. Its hind legs have little...
Wait, on its hind legs?
Yeah. Or it stores it in its hind legs.
It has
the only mammal.
A little hooks on
its hind
legs.
Only mammal with venom?
Yes, it is.
So why are they calling it a mammal? It should be its own phylum.
I think because it...
Because we like to classify things in neat, tidy little piles.
I wouldn't classify it as a mammal at this point. It's something else.
It's something else.
We'll just have a whole separate animal kingdom called... The duck-billed platypus animal kingdom, and it'll only have one member, the duck-billed platypus.
All right. Oh. By the way, the knitted version of, what is it, Oog?
Ood.
Ood is great. It just looks wonderful.
It's wonderful.
It's pretty good representation of it. You know, I could understand why they'd be like, hey, this is a, you know, if they've somehow copyrighted the Ood design, you know, then yeah, I guess they're infringing on it.
All right, next news story, we will go. Thanks for the platypus, Ben. We'll go ahead and go back to Alex. Hi, Alex. What's your next story, sir?
Hi, Lyle. Let's talk about some space exploration, you know, stuff. Well, sort of. Let's talk about NASA. NASA is actually teaming up with JAXA, which is the, what does it exactly stands for? It's the Japanese, kind of equivalent. And they're working on trying to take the boom out of the sonic boom.
Don't you just go slower to do that?
Yeah, but then you're kind of not really going faster than the speed of sound, right?
Yeah, it's true.
You only get a sonic boom if you're going at the speed of sound, right? Once you pass the speed of sound, you no longer have a sonic boom.
Yeah,
right?
It's just when you cross that threshold,
right? And the boom is that
when your
point.
Sound wave becomes a shock wave.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, is there a particular reason why they're doing this, Alex, or is it just because they can?
Well, I think they're trying, I mean, I don't know what their motivations are, but they've been looking to kind of do that for a while. I know that JAXA has been, had a lot of research that's been going into understanding just exactly, you know, how the sonic boom is forming, you know, what it is about the shape or, you know, the wings or anything that can influence whether or not there is a sonic boom. So they're kind of just looking to find a way to get rid of it. Apparently it's caused by only just a few pounds per square foot, which is they say is equivalent to an elevator, the acceleration of an elevator kind of going up or down a few floors. So it's really not that much. So they're trying to understand it more. I mean, I could think of a few reasons to have that, you know, or to remove that for one military reasons. I mean, you want to be able to hide it.
What you're saying is potentially the boom is created at a certain, a very specific type of place. And if you accelerated slower during that very specific time frame, you might not get the boom.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe minimize the air displacement.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it might be the air displacement. There's the sonic boom is basic. There's actually two booms. There's one at the tail and one at the nose.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, you know, they're kind of studying that more closely to understand how to remove it.
Does the sonic boom happen at every increase of past the sound barrier? Or does it just happen in the initial?
No, it's only at that one point.
It's Mach 1.
At the point where it passes the speed of sound. Once it's passed, there is no additional booms.
And this is a research question at this point.
Correct.
That's great.
They're researching it right now. And you know, NASA wouldn't mind having the sonic boom removed from the shuttle, although, I don't know, it's kind of neat when you hear the shuttle come in, but
yeah,
just imagine everybody's waiting for the boom.
I don't think we'd be modifying the shuttle's flight. Like, we're okay with that, but I could just imagine future vehicles. Of course, giant boom is also wasted energy, right? Because anytime you've got a large use of energy, the source has to come from somewhere. So it actually probably takes a bit of energy from the craft itself.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, it's not that much, that much force to it, but you know, who knows how much it actually costs and in the the structure of the aircraft and all that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Alex, very much for that.
Sure.
Okay. The Who's Knitting copyright issue is up on our website if you want to see the images. Go ahead, Ryder. What's your next news story, sir?
So VW is actually making some headway on the front of fuel-efficient vehicles. One that caught my eye was there's an L1 concept car that as far in 2010 they intend on making it a production reality, which is the cool thing about this car. It's pretty unique looking, futuristic, small. It's kind of has a cockpit seating arrangement where you have one person in the front, one in the back, very low to the ground. But the main thing is that it gets 100 kilometers per liter of fuel, which is equivalent to 235 miles per gallon.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and you know, real world testing is probably going to work out to be more like 200 miles per gallon, but that's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
So. So 2010, look for that, and then currently a concept car.
Concept car, and in 2010 will be its release.
Yes,
that's pretty impressive.
Yes.
So probably 2011
Which,
model.
You know, seeing concept cars ever become reality is impressive.
It's always impressive. Yeah,
and also VW in 2008 is coming out. Is it 2008? I believe. Very soon, maybe next year. Also a concept car, but 60 mile per hour VW Jetta TDI diesel. Which is going to be one of the most stringent, the air quality, you know, the LEV,
emissions.
Whatever the emissions controls, mm-hmm. very high emissions control standard. And that's going to be coming out, I think, next year. Basically, it's a 2-liter four-cylinder turbocharged engine, you know, diesel. So run on biofuel, probably. That's
right.
Very, very popular with biofuel enthusiasts to run these Jettas.
So a clean biodiesel vehicle, that's really compelling. Because right now, you definitely smell the exhaust, and the cleaner the output of it, the nicer it would be. Why is diesel so expensive? Diesel's the same price, if not higher than gas, and yet it didn't used to be that way. I know.
Mm-hmm. I remember taking a cross-country trip about 13 years ago, and it was significantly cheaper. You know, I rented a big truck and hauled all my stuff.
What's interesting about that is that the reason gas is higher is, of course, the issue of refinement for gas, but also it's an issue of taxes. There's more taxes on gas, I think, than diesel. But so it's raised up now, which seems a little strange to me. But mm-hmm. since we... You know, I just keep on asking a lot of questions we don't have answers to.
You know, and there's also there's a new biofuel company that's set up shop over on Ocean Street. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I guess.
And what I always thought me was interesting was that it's sort of, and I haven't checked it recently, but when it came out, it was tracking with the price of diesel,
mm-hmm.
which seemed kind of artificial to me. You know, is it just because that's what the market would bear? And I'm, you know, anybody's driven by there, is it still tracking with the price of diesel? I'm very curious on that. Or is it, you know, now that regular gasoline is $4 a gallon, is it, you know, or have they maintained their $2.50 or $3 that it used to be? I'm curious on that. Make it much more appealing, wouldn't it?
Well, again, if you'd like to answer these and many questions we're asking of you today, please feel free to contact us.
This is all reversed.
In just a few minutes.
Hey,
what we should do is go, my computer's broken, I can't figure it out, please call me and help me.
I'm having this issue.
We'll be taking calls in about 5 minutes or so. Another news story, whose turn is it? I think Ben. Go for it, Ben.
All right. So I want to talk about the center of the Earth and how in elementary school I learned that the Earth's schematic is there's a core, and then there's the mantle, and then there's the crust.
Sure.
And it's simple. Right. And it's, you know, it's pretty uniform mantle.
And the pictures are real pretty, and there's like orange hot gore stuff.
Molten lava. Yeah. Man, molten lava was the best thing in the world when you're a little kid, you know?
Yeah, of course.
Don't step on the cracks. They're hot lava.
All right, next news story.
No, anyway, so that's my news story.
Yeah. Just I like the earth.
Basic geology. Yeah.
I like the earth. Well, anyway, apparently it's not nearly as simple as that, and it's more like this article has a really interesting metaphor. It says it's like the gooey center of a chocolate morsel harboring peanut butter and honey. The inner earth is far more nuanced than outward appearances would suggest.
And are we talking about the core, or are we talking about the core mantle combo?
Just all of it, I think.
Huh.
I got the impression that there's a core, but there's an outer core and an inner core. There's the outer mantle and the inner mantle, and none of this is uniform at all. So there are these piles of what the article describes as peanut butter, where and in reality, of course, this is really, really hard rock, but under those pressures and at those heats, it flows more freely. But they're getting all of this data from looking at earthquakes and how seismic activity goes through the earth and how quickly it goes through
and
the earth.
And it's not as simple as one would think.
It's not as simple as, oh, from this point to that point, that's this distance, and so it travels this quickly through the earth, because the earth isn't uniform. And so they've got these big chunks. Okay, I don't remember where that was in the article. But
it's okay.
Anyway, it's pretty interesting.
So a
your elementary harmly, school teacher is wrong.
Yeah. It's the Earth's more complicated. Is it still? We still believe that the magnetic poles are due to current flows of the iron. That's not changing, right? You don't know.
I
chop
don't.
It up to one more.
No.
Please
so
answer.
You hit the core with the hotter and cooler portions of the magma or whatever's flowing at the center. Mm-hmm. That they'll switch polarity or cause.
Well, no, just that's the reason why we have a magnetic. That's the assumption. That's why. Mars, for example, doesn't have active volcanoes and doesn't have a magnetic pole.
I went to the
isn't very
Natural History
life.
Museum in New York a few years ago, and they had a nice presentation on that. And they were saying it's happened before. It's
The switch.
Yeah, the switch, and it's likely to happen again. And it's actually due.
And it would do pretty much nothing to us. It wouldn't really affect anything.
You don't think it would change the polarity of the planet?
It'll affect the polarity of the poles, sure, and then all the compasses will point the other direction, but pretty much that's about it, I used to think, in my youth, I would be like, oh, my gosh, and there'll be this electric discharge. And blah, blah, blah. At the time, I was working at a little electronics company, and the engineer said, and how much voltage would it produce? I'm like,
so probably,
see, it's one
don't you
switch,
think it would affect, like, bird migration and things like that?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of, well, I don't know. I don't know if birds are going to.
Oh, there's an article about birds that they see electromagnetic fields.
Birds
they physically
are smart.
See them.
See them in a sense that they sense them.
No, well, they can see the blue. Yeah, they can. Blue light. No, literally, there's an article about that.
Oh, really?
Can see
it's
them,
actually close to their optic nerve.
Yeah.
The little piece of metal in their head.
You can inject a small magnet or just a small piece of metal in someone's right or left arm. And over the course of several months, they'll learn which way is north just based on the very, very subtle senses. And they'll just always have an idea of which way is north.
Did you see the body modding? Cool? Did you hear the body modding Geek Speak episode we talked about where people can put, you can insert a little magnet in your hand and you can you can feel current flow by just putting your hand in it?
Uh-huh.
Very similar to that.
Oh,
I didn't
wow.
know that you could. But so if I was wearing a ring that was not like gold or platinum, whatever this is, I could actually slowly over time know where the fields are.
I'm not sure about the specifics of it.
You're basically saying I'm not sensitive.
Maybe
enough.
You're not cool
Thanks,
enough.
Ben. Thanks a lot.
but I'll just tell you the most frustrating thing about this article, reading this article.
Please.
Is that now I really want to eat a chocolate morsel that harbors peanut butter and honey. Oh, God. I'm so hungry.
So
now.
You're
thinking
so attached.
Planetary peanut butter cup, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Ben makes really good peanut butter cups, by the way.
Yeah.
Wow. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. We're asking you questions and comments today about other things, and you're welcome to answer them by calling 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org. and click on Contact Us to send us emails. Yeah. KOSP co-sponsors the Santa Cruz Educational Foundation presentation of the River Arts Festival. The festival takes place on May 17th and 18th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the San Lorenzo Park in the heart of Santa Cruz. This exotic new annual arts festival offers contemporary arts and crafts, live demonstrations of art techniques, art installations, hands-on art activities for all ages, musical performance, displays on local ecology and fine food. Admission is free. For more information, go online to riverartsfestival.com. And that is May 17th and 18th from 11 to 5. Coming up after Geek Speak, in about a half an hour, PJ Swift is here to do Castle Cottage, our weekly kids program. And PJ's quite good at it, and she's getting prepared already. So I'm sure it will be a wonderful show. So stay tuned for that. This is Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Ben Jaffe and Ryder Brooks. And over the phone, we have Alex Slias. And you are welcome to join us as well over the phone to ask us anything you'd like about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can also correct us on a myriad of issues that we've brought up during this first half of the program. Specifically, I'm still interested in if there's another term for a person who knits. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP, 1-800-655-KUSP. And Rick Philman, our phone answer, is waiting for your call. Ben, while we have this moment where we're waiting for calls, you are welcome to talk about TiddlyWiki.
TiddlyWiki. So.
Yes, what is TiddlyWiki?
You showed me TiddlyWiki.
Ben, let me teach you a little bit of a thing about radio. My job is to act like an idiot, and I do a good job of it, I think, and ask questions that I might know the answers to, but because it's better to have a conversation than for me to lecture.
I'm so glad that you asked.
Wait, let me keep talking.
You should try TiddlyWiki. It's really amazing.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I've been using it for years.
Wow, that's amazing. No, I just discovered this. A friend introduced me to it, and it's this HTML file that has CSS and JavaScript, and it can self-edit itself. And basically
it can edit itself.
Edit itself.
It can't self-edit itself. That would be redundant.
And repetitive, too.
Yes, go on.
Oh, boy.
So first off, let's back up a second.
Every
web page that you go to is an HTML document, actually, and the browser shows that as a thing that has colors and images and text and all that stuff. But if you save that document to your file system as a .htm or .html document and then open it in your browser, it can operate pretty much like it operates online, and that's what this document does. But instead of being on a web server somewhere, it's on your local system like a Word document or something, and it can edit itself. Well, why is that important? What does it do?
It's a TiddlyWiki. I'm having issues describing this.
Let's start over. Okay. I'm going to talk about TiddlyWiki. Ben, please ask me a question about TiddlyWiki.
All right, what's TiddlyWiki, Lyle?
TiddlyWiki is... Okay, we'll come into it again. But basically, the web browser has become this very complicated application, and it can do a lot of things in the application. You know, we've got examples of that with YouTube, where it's running a Flash application that's showing a video. And we've got examples of that on this Ajax world we're living in, where you can be on a web page and do things and actually modify the database in the back end, which is on the web server, without actually reloading the page. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. Most of the cool stuff that's kind of dynamic is being done by a scripting language called JavaScript. And JavaScript is one of the basic tools you need to understand to be a really good web developer. And there's three of them. You need to know HTML, you need to know JavaScript, and you need to know, at this point, CSS, which is a styling thing for HTML. In any case, the JavaScript engine, when it's on a local file system, when you have the file locally, actually can access your file system and it prompts you to do so. What this means is if you have an HTML document that's written correctly with a lot of JavaScript in it, you can type into the form in the page, push submit, and instead of that going to a website, the JavaScript will take that content, edit the document up itself that it is, and resave it and save itself. And what you get is a HTML document that can be a full wiki, and a wiki is a very simple to edit website. In any case, it's become a way that you're, in the last couple of days, Ben, you've been, I guess just one day, you've
My
become
whole
an
life
expert.
Is on TiddlyWiki.
Yeah, it's basically kind of like a content management system for yourself. So a giant to-do list, and the cool thing is it's just, since it's an HTML document, you can put it on a fob and carry it around with you.
And
I know, USB memory stick.
Oh. Thumb drive, jump drive, stick.
So will you please, Ben, go edit geekspeak.org
yeah, of course.
And add in the links to TillyWiki in our main content.
The great
section.
Thing about being a wiki, too, is that you can have your pages link to each other. Mm-hmm. And so I can have a work page, and then on that work page I can have all of my different projects that I'm working on. And then
and
within those,
not,
I can have...
It's not different web pages. It's all a web application on one page.
That's true. They're called tittlers.
Tittlers. Very strange term.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's kind of a fun thing to play with. If you're a web developer, it's kind of like, whoa, that's amazing. And I highly recommend you take a look at geekspeak.org to see what we're talking about.
I actually sent it to my dad, and he was skeptical. I was like, okay, I'll try that. Because he's been on this like year-long search for how to manage all of his to-do stuff, and he's got a lot of it. And he emailed me yesterday. He's like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Thank you so much. You know, I'm going to...
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh.
Well, let's take our first call. You're welcome to call us with questions and comments. There's only one person waiting, so you'll be quick on air. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. From Santa Cruz, John, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey. So my problem is that I've been trying to burn CDs.
Do you have your radio on in the background?
No, I don't.
Hmm. All right, go on. You're trying to burn CDs.
Okay, and my CD-ROM works just fine for everything, except for when I try and do the copy to CD, it doesn't seem to notice it. It won't recognize that there's a CD in there at all. It tells me. That's the message I get. There is no...
There's no blank CD in there?
Exactly.
So you're trying to copy a CD. Do you have two CD drives in there or just one?
I have one.
Okay, so that is kind of a problem because the application, of course, has to copy all the stuff from the CD and then put a blank one in and burn it back. Are you talking about burning or are you just talking about copying the actual CD itself?
Well, burning.
Okay. So what application are you using on your HP?
It's a Windows... Windows XP Home Edition.
So you're using the operating system itself as the software to burn the CD?
Yeah, it's the media player.
Oh, media player, okay. So you're burning music?
Right.
Okay. And is this a DVD burner or just a plain CD burner?
It's just a plain. Well, I think it actually should be able to do DVDs
okay,
too,
but
I think.
You're actually using a CD media to burn onto, though? You're not using
that's it? That's right. It's
do you think it's a do you think it's a copyright issue, Ryder?
No.
No? Okay. What would you recommend?
First
off, Alex, if you could try to mute your mic pickup for a second or something, because we're getting feedback, and I think it might be because of that. Anyway.
This is one of those kind of really vague ones.
I mean, know.
It could be a hardware problem. I would try burning with another program. Sometimes some of these Windows PCs have software included that allows you the capability of doing direct drag kind of copy and burning onto your drive,
uh-huh.
which is proprietary to that software to be able to read it later. I have in some cases seen that interferes with other programs trying to use burning software. So if you have any resident programs that are somehow CD drive related,
if
you might want to try turning those off.
If your machine came with a CD burner and it probably has another application to use rather than just the operating system, and I would definitely try to use that first. It's pretty common for Toast or some version of Roxio to be on your system, and you might want to give that a shot. But you can also go... a lot of these applications that burn CDs, you can download and use for a period of time to try them out. And I've used Roxio in the past and have liked it. So you might want to try going up and getting that and downloading Roxio from their site and seeing if that will work. And if it works, then go ahead and invest in the amount of money that it is.
Does iTunes on Windows that allow you to burn?
Yeah. Oh, iTunes is a good
free
thing.
Yeah.
So if you go to Apple and get iTunes for your machine, you can burn audio CDs with iTunes. And that's a test of whether your hardware is actually working.
But you might actually want to go into your system properties. There's a device manager in the system properties section. There's a device tab. If you go in there and find your CD burner in there, you might want to take a look at the advanced properties and see if it actually recognizes it as a burner.
No, that's a good question, because I've done some troubleshooting and I've gotten to the point to where I saw that it wasn't do that. It wasn't recognizing it.
Yeah.
But so what I did is I went into the registry, and now it does recognize that much of it, but
okay.
It just will not.
Wait a second.
Recognize.
Are you sure that you have a CD burner?
Yes.
How do you know? Does it say like RW in the front of it?
Presumably, it's worked in the past, I guess.
Have you ever burned a CD with it?
No, I'm new at this. Oh.
Okay, so if it's possible you've got a CD drive that doesn't burn CDs. If that's the case, going and editing the register to say, this is a burner, would work in the sense that it would show up as a burner, but it wouldn't actually be a burner. I would go to, since you have an HP computer, I'd go to HP's site, look up your model number, download the most recent drivers for your computer from them, which will include CD burning drivers, if you will, the drivers correctly for that drive. And if it's a burner, that might improve the problem as well. Mm-hmm. But you'd also learn in going to HP's site, looking at your model, to really read, yes, this is a CD burner, which might be nice. Of course, it's also possible that it's broken.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the call.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. Okay, let's see. From Soquel, Rich, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning. Sonic booms. I might have misunderstood what you said because I was in the middle of washing my car, but did you imply that when a plane exceeds the sound barrier, there's a sonic boom only once?
Twice, actually.
Twice?
To the front of the plane and the back of the plane.
Yeah,
it happens
I believe
quickly.
Actually it's continuous. As long, in other words, on the ground, there's a cone in the air that conveys the boom, and it everywhere the plane flies over at supersonic speed, there's a boom on the ground. And so that the thing they're studying would be really important for flying super above the speed of sound over land.
So that does make sense to some degree. Alex, do you understand what he's saying?
Yeah, I do, actually. He very well may be right. I'm not that an expert on sonic.
Yeah, I remember as a kid, I lived in Cincinnati, and B-58 Hustlers used to fly supersonically to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and they would break windows all across Cincinnati. And then in the newspaper, they said, think of it as the sound of freedom.
Yeah, the sound of visiting your glass store is what it is. Okay, so this is another one of those things where I should have my physics down a little bit better. I tend to agree that that's actually the pattern that actually happens, that you're producing a standing waveform by passing the speed of sound.
Right, and I think the pilot only hears it once.
Well, you'd hear it as it passes you, basically.
Yeah.
Right, and so
actually,
it passes.
I just looked that up, and that's exactly it.
When it passes the aircraft, the pilot would hear it, right? And it would be then behind him.
Right.
Though the pilot might be cushioned from that.
The pilot would only hear a sonic boom from the wings or engines less than the speed of sound.
Right.
Because
yeah.
if he's going past the speed of sound, he's traveling faster than the sound.
I get that. What I'm saying is when the nose breaks the sound barrier, it passes through the barrier, if you will, passes
through. So we're saying when you exceed it, it's still continuing even though you pass the threshold?
Right. The pilot doesn't hear it, but on the ground you do.
So if you're going for 1,000 miles at supersonic speeds, everyone hears it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, basically,
I was just looking that up and basically you have cones on the nose and on the tail, and those cones kind of travel with the plane, and they extend all the way down to the ground. So like when they go past us, that's when we hear the sonic boom, but it's actually traveling with the plane.
Now, is this even when it's going something like Mach 2 or something?
Yeah.
So would the cone actually be behind the plane at that point?
Oh, yeah.
Really stretched.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes more sense in some sense.
Yeah, that would make much more sense why they would want to eliminate that.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a big deal.
Well, that's a big that's a big waste as well, the energy waste of producing that wave, that standing waveform, if you will.
Yeah.
It's not really standing, but... Well, thank you very much for the call.
Sure. Great.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks.
That was Rich from SoCal calling in to clarify the sonic boom issue. We're still waiting for other clarifications. We've asked a lot of questions today, so you're welcome to participate. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Get on the news story. While we wait for calls.
We have line 3.
Totally ignored it. Sorry about that. Larry from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to Geek Speak.
I'm sorry, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. Good morning. How are you?
We're quite well. Thank you.
Good. Okay, my question for you. Okay, backing up a little bit. I'd like to say is I operate a small one-man home-based business. And I'm working right now on developing my marketing plan. What I've done already is kind of nailed down my email campaign. I've got that pretty well down. And my next project is create a web page for my business. Now, having said that, I'm calling you to get your ideas on what I could do, either inexpensively or for free, to essentially optimize my web pages, search engine, feature.
So search engine optimization, the biggest thing for this is have good content that people will search for and answer those questions. So doing keywords and titles and stuff like that gets you a little ways, but really the best thing to do is to make sure that you have content that is applicable to the searches that they're talking about.
Okay,
So one way to do that, for example, is if you're a certain niche and you're talking about like knitting supplies, you're selling knitting supplies, have articles about knitting so that when people start, and then what will happen is it's twofold. The search engine will see that you're talking about the topic and you're curious about it and interested in it. And it'll also show that if other people get interested in the knitting community and they link to you, their interest proves to the search engine that you are a good source for that. So you kind of give away free information that then attracts the people that you want to see your site. And that's generally how to do it. You can also get into paid programs where you actually start paying for links to you. Mm-hmm. But the return value, I think, then is very low. The other thing to do, of course, is to pay for advertising. With like Google AdSense or something. But that would be my recommendation, is have really good content about your business. Thank you very much, Larry, for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, that's a pretty complicated topic, actually, search engine optimization.
And if you try to cheat the system, you're actually breaking the rules to some degree, and you can get blacklisted from the search engine, which is very bad for you. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. From Aptos, Helen, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I have two questions. One, I feel almost embarrassed to ask, but is there a difference between a Macintosh pocketbook and laptop?
There's a MacBook.
When they say MacBook,
right,
or a pocketbook or a laptop? Is it the same thing?
I've never heard pocketbook. There's a MacBook.
Yeah.
And there's a laptop, and they are pretty much the same thing. There's different models of laptop computers.
But they're basically the same?
Laptop and notebook are two words that are used interchangeably.
Right. Okay. Well, so Apple's marketing scheme at this point, they call one a MacBook, which is a lower-end laptop.
Uh-huh.
And they have a MacBook Pro, which is a higher-end one. And basically, they're different feature sets, but they're all the same.
So my next question, what would you recommend... I like the Macintosh because they're very easy to operate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for something like a MacBook or a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you both, all of you, recommend?
Well, do you definitely want portability of a MacBook? I mean, of a laptop, excuse me.
Yeah, uh-huh. I want portability, but I don't want something really expensive either.
Then
you know,
I would get the, if you're really, really interested in price, then I would buy it used and find an old MacBook Pro or a MacBook.
Buy a used one?
If you want to reduce the price quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you want to make sure that the computer is an Intel laptop, because that means that it still has a pretty long life of use. Mm-hmm.
And it should be a 5 or more, Tiger, I think they have a Tiger.
OS 10, yeah. Basically,
no, it's Leopard now, I think.
Leopard's the newest one. So operating system 10, which I wouldn't recommend having a Macintosh that doesn't have operating system 10 on it, because it would be actually kind of old too. There's multiple flavors. We're up to Leopard, which is 0.5, so there's been 5 versions of it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's 6 versions of it.
So is that pretty good, the Leopard?
10.
There's
Leopard. Yeah, if it has Leopard on it, it's a relatively new computer. Yeah. That's right.
But, and is that pretty good?
Yeah. Leopard and Tiger is the older version, 0.4. They're both fine.
If you want to buy a new MacBook, I would just go with, and cost is a concern, I'd go with the base MacBook, which is a 12-inch screen. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think it's a 12-inch.
It's pretty powerful. Most people are happy with it. It's very compact.
It'll come with OS 10 5, which is Leopard.
And it's significantly cheaper than the MacBook Pro.
Yeah. And
OS 10, and it's called what? The MacBook?
Just
the
MacBook. MacBook, yeah.
Just MacBook. It's going to be white mm-hmm. in colored.
Uh-huh.
The MacBook Pros are silver.
And it comes with the OS 10 5.
It does.
Leopard.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of other applications that come with it.
Okay.
I would, if you really want to reduce costs as much as possible and you know like a college student, uh-huh. the best thing to do is get a university cost laptop, because I think they knock off at like another $99.
I know.
And that will help a little bit as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Bye-bye.
You know what's interesting is most manufacturers don't call it a laptop anymore, because then it's implied that you can use it on your lap. And recently, actually, it wasn't recently, but I know that there
I think
was.
It was recently. I think it was like we covered.
There was an issue with Apple and people complaining about heat issues when they used it on their lap, and Apple's response was, "Oh, well, it's a notebook. It's not a laptop. Don't use it on your lap," which is ridiculous. You know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, to some degree, it kind of makes sense. You've got to have a table to use it.
Yeah.
It's just that it's really portable.
Yeah.
You're just somebody that actually sits on a couch and uses a computer. Yeah, I never put this thing on my lap. No.
Really?
It's very ergonomically incorrect.
It's uncomfortable. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Hurts you, you know, after when you're in your 30s, Ben, you can talk about this, okay?
Hey, I'm in my 30s. I put it on my lap all the time.
Well, which one do you have? Do you have the Air? For your lap.
Oh, that wouldn't change ergonomics, though, Lyle.
No, but that would change, like, effectiveness. Alex, do you have an Air?
An Air?
A MacBook Air.
MacBook Air.
No. Mine's just an older G4, what do they call them, Ben? PowerBook. Bro.
And you use it on your lap?
Yeah, I use it all the time on my lap. But I mean, it's a little warm, but...
But that's not fair. You're very portable. You've got an iPhone and an iPod Touch. I mean, come on, how much more crazy can you be in some ways?
Seriously.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a valid argument, though. These things are meant to be portable and be able to use them anywhere. If you're in the airport, you put it on your lap. If
you don't have
anywhere
a desk,
you are, you're going to be putting these on your lap. So they need to take that into consideration when they design laptops.
Right. I mean, the thing is, they've been hot. The laptops have been hot for so long now that I normally like to. I mean, I do two things. I have kind of a big book or a board that goes with my laptop to protect the screen. So from compression, and so I can normally use that to put on my lap to then put the laptop on top of it, and then a hot laptop doesn't matter that nearly as much.
Mm-hmm. But it's not hot because it's not. But the big sitting
thing,
on cloth.
The thing that stresses me about putting a notebook computer on my lap is that I have to be conscious of the airflow, and if it's on a flat surface, I don't have to be conscious nearly as much. So like if I have it on my lap and I've got on jeans and my jeans are coming up and touching the back air vents, it's going to get hotter and hotter, and it's going to slow down. And so while I'm using it, I don't feel comfortable. Alex, how do you get past the comfortability of using it on your lap?
I just don't worry about it.
I guess you're less stressed than me.
Actually, on mine, the vents are a bit more... Actually, where are my vents? I don't even see them anywhere.
See, now that you know, you'll be conscious of it.
Actually, it's kind of hard to cover up. It actually is kind of between the screen and the hinge there.
Yeah.
So it kind of comes up underneath in front.
You're skinnier than me, too, so there you go. Ray from Monterey. Ray, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question today?
I want to know, regarding firewalls, when, if any time, should they be let down? I recently acquired high-speed service, and the technician over the phone, at one point when the firewall came up, he prompted me to let the firewall down or disengage it. And then sure enough, I don't know if this was actually what happened, but within several hours, I had this thing installing that was called WeatherBug. It says, we'll give you the weather anytime you want.
Yikes.
Malware.
I know. And literally, it just set itself right in front of the desktop, like a little bug.
Mm-hmm. So
I couldn't delete it, and the only way I got rid of it was by going to... add, remove, program.
And the thing with those things is that you never know if you really delete them because they're very
malicious.
So I
would say that the quick answer to that is the only time that you would want to open up a hole in your firewall or turn down your firewall is if you have a specific reason that somebody needs to access your computer directly. Either you're hosting a service, say you had like a mini web server, or if you wanted to stream out media from your computer and people need to connect directly to your computer to access that. Those are the only type of circumstances that you would really want to open up. Or if you're playing games.
And most of these services that you're like a game or an application you have to connect to your computer, they normally have instructions on how to not turn off your firewall, but how to make your firewall accept them, which is the better way to do it. Now, I got to ask you, do you have a DSL modem that plugs right into your computer?
Service came with a router.
Yeah.
And
see, the router is an effective block off of what's called port scanning and being in running applications like that. It's kind of like a physical firewall. It's not really actually a firewall. But Alex, do you want to talk a little bit about how you got this great article? If you want to read an article about firewalls and making your computer safe, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on our blog. And Alex wrote a pretty extensive thing on making your home more safe. But Alex, do you want to cover some tricks right now?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I mean, you should have your modem and then you should have your router. So you should have two devices between your computer and the wall.
I do.
And, the router will more or less, it does what's called NATing, which it creates its own address space behind on your side.
Right.
and then it has the address for the internet. So it's kind of acting as your computer as far as the internet is concerned, and then it puts blocks so you can't really get in by default.
So that your local computer having a firewall on top of that is almost kind of redundant in some ways.
Well,
so it's kind of curious
no,
to me. But it's also curious to me how you could have gotten infected by taking down your firewall on your computer. Alex, what do you mean yes or no? How is the firewall even more helpful?
Well, the firewall can also block outgoing requests. So if you do happen to get malware and they ship off data, having a local firewall that actually acts to block outbound connections can be of help. That way you can allow certain programs to connect out, and a new program that has never been seen can be blocked. That way, if some sort of malware gets in, it can't easily sneak the data out of your system.
So what at this point should Ray do?
First thing, he's got to get rid of the malware, clean the system, get some sort of, spyware, or I don't know why the names are skipping my mind. Come on, guys, you can help me out here.
Spybot Search and Destroy is one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
The three that I have currently is the spyware, Zapper, the virus scan, and the firewall. But there's really nothing more than those three, right, that's available.
Well, the question is, are those good solutions? Because there's actually most people that make malware and viruses run it past a few of the most prominent tools to get rid of them to see if they check. They get checked. And if they pass those, then they launch them into the wild, if you will. So to some degree, you actually need a multitude of these tools installed in your machine to clean it up. I know it's quite frustrating, of course, because it's not a simple solution, but I don't have one. I'm frustrated with myself. Alex, do you got a good solution for this problem?
It's hard because, like you said, some of them, sometimes they can sneak by, but, the best solution really is to make sure your system is patched. That way you don't get them in the first place when you do have them. I know Adaware is a pretty good one to use. WeatherBug itself is not, it's not malware in that it's going to trying to cause harm or steal data. It's actually adware.
Right.
It's not as harmful as some of the others, but it's still annoying.
And therefore, uninstalling it through add remove programs is probably fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. We have a few more people on the phone, but I don't think we're able to get to them. We're running short on time today, so... go ahead, and anyone has questions for us, you're welcome to ask us questions at our forums. Alex, who's on the phone with us today, is an administrator of our forums, and he set up this great tool. We answer questions all the time for people. The address is at geekspeak.org, and just click on forums and ask questions there, and we'll answer them. There's a whole smorgasbord of geeks waiting for you. And Alex, again, thank you for this. It's been a great service to our community.
You're welcome.
You are listening to GeekSpeak. And we're about to say goodbye and say hello to PJ Swift, who's going to be doing Castle Cottage. I want to let you know that GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. The geeks this morning were Alex Slias down in Southern California. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Lyle.
Ryder Brooks, right here in the room with me. Ryder?
Thank you.
And squeaking in just in time, Ben Jaffe. Thank you, Ben, for waking up for us today.
Thank you.
Answering the phones, as he is every week, is Rick Philman. Rick, thank you so much. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. And GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Broadcasting HD Radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arto, on the web at kusp.org. We will be back next week talking about skepticism with Stephen Novella from the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Audio, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.